Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Still to come in the next hour of the programme, smog-like air has swamped a large swathe of the United States. We'll be finding out what's going on. Guillaume Balaguer on Messi's surprise move to Miami. And John Cook visits Moyross, where a new schools programme aims to break the cycle of deprivation and stigma. Now though, later on this month, the future of Ireland's neutrality and its ability to defend itself will be up for discussion as part of the consultative forum on international security policy. This country's position in an increasingly perilous world is the subject of a new book called Is Ireland Neutral? The Many Myths of Irish Neutrality. And the author is Conor Gallagher, crime and security correspondent with the Irish Times. And Conor is here. Conor, you're very welcome and congratulations on the new and very interesting book. And it's so timely because we've had a lot of debate around the question of neutrality lately, and we've been asking just how neutral this country really is and what it means to us. Can you give us your best attempt? I know this is difficult, but your best attempt at defining Irish neutrality.
Yeah, it's an incredibly difficult question. And when I started writing this book, I had no idea what a difficult task that would be. Neutrality is a concept that's as old as, you know, nation states. You know, Greek city states were claiming neutrality in various wars back in ancient Greece. But it's only in kind of the 19th century, which has been called the golden age of neutrality, that it's first kind of codified in international law. That's when you have Switzerland being recognised as neutral by the major European powers. And then in 1907, you have the Hague Convention, which details the rights and obligations of neutral nations. But unfortunately, still doesn't give us a definition of what is a neutral nation. Mm-hmm. So Ireland has developed its own entirely unique version of neutrality, and it's really up for debate whether the term neutrality applies. The government has variously called it traditional neutrality, qualified neutrality, and most recently military neutrality. So at times that's meant, you know, staying completely out of wars, such as the Spanish Civil War, which I think could be argued was the high point of Irish neutrality. That's when De Valera's government imposed laws that basically forbid people to go and fight in the Spanish Civil War on either side. And he even sent a kind of a nascent kind of peacekeeping force or proto peacekeeping force to other ports to ensure that munitions and supplies weren't going to either side in Spain. Now, of course, that didn't work. We had the Blue Shirts went to fight on Franco's side, and the IRA went to fight on the Republican side. But it was the highest point in the government's efforts to enforce neutrality.
And neutrality was important then, when we were a very new state, to distance ourselves from our colonial masters of the past, wasn't it? We're not with those guys. That's what we wanted to tell the world.
Yeah, that's probably the most broadly accepted reason why we were neutral in World War II. Because De Valera is thought as a way of carving out our own kind of reputation on the world stage as being the newest kid on the block, who was not the only dominion of the British Empire that didn't join in the war on the Allied side. There are other reasons, though, of course, which are arguably just as important. Number one is our defence forces was all but non-existent from a defence point of view, meaning we couldn't have afforded to defend ourselves if we were a belligerent in the war, never mind going on any kind of expeditionary endeavours. And then, of course, there was the very real threat of civil war. We were still only 15 years or so after the end of the Civil War. You still had this massive depth of feeling against the British Empire, and De Valera knew that if he was to join with the Allies, it could very easily reinvigorate the IRA, and that message might spread beyond, and you might actually have some sort of civil war.
And you write about the interesting conclusion of MI5 in the aftermath of the war. What did they decide about Ireland's neutrality?
Yeah, so I spent a good bit of the book kind of going through maybe the lesser known ways we assisted the Allies in the war. So it's what De Valera called, you know, the certain consideration we gave the Allies. But this went far beyond a certain consideration, to the point where, you know, neutrality was basically a total misnomer. You know, and some of those ways are very well known, like repatriating Allied pilots and including sometimes repatriating their planes, including sometimes if a pilot crash landed, giving them a nice big banquet lunch and then sending them back across the border to Northern Ireland and then fixing their planes and sending the planes back and then giving the intelligence on the planes to the Allies. But I also wanted to focus on the lesser known aspects and including the intelligence war. And, you know, the Defence Forces Intelligence Bureau was then called G2. They were at times basically a joint intelligence partner to the Allies, to MI5 and MI6 and the OSS, the forerunner, the CIA. They got every cooperation they could have asked for, including, you know, when German spies parachuted into Ireland, they were almost immediately caught and were interrogated, and the results of that interrogation were passed immediately to the Allies. You know, the weather reports is obviously quite famous. The weather reading taken at Blacksod Lighthouse, which persuaded Eisenhower to delay D-Day by one day, thereby saving thousands and thousands of troops and arguably ensuring the success of the landing. But at the same time, German spies, there's one anecdote which I thought was quite illustrative of German spies having to get weather reports in Ireland by looking at barometers in shop windows. Such was our assistance in that regard that, as you said, British intelligence services in their post-mortem after the war said a neutral Ireland was actually more beneficial to the British war effort than an Ireland which joined the Allies. That's because if Ireland joined the war, the Brits would have had to garrison it. They would have had to give us lots of anti-air defences and that sort of thing, which were in very, very short supply in the early parts of the war. And it would have meant that thousands and thousands of people who joined Irish people who joined the British forces, and more so the British war machine, the British factories and that were building this war machine, they wouldn't have been available because most of them would have been conscripted into an Irish army. They would have been sitting around on Ireland for an invasion that might never have come. The Brits were able to have their cake and eat it too because they still got all this intelligence cooperation. Yeah.
So then we come to after the Second World War when NATO was formed. Now this might seem like a bizarre question, but why didn't we join it then? What were the reasons for us opting out?
So this is one of the other kind of foundational myths of Irish neutrality. And even if you look at a 1996 white paper document on what Ireland's foreign policy should be, and that states very clearly that Ireland didn't join NATO because our commitment to neutrality, and that is bogus, completely wrong. Ireland was very much interested in joining NATO when it was being kicked around start in 1946, but in the late 40s. The British approached the inter-party government and our Minister for External Affairs, Sean McBride, and said, would you be interested if, you know, someone made an approach, what would happen there, to be a founding member of NATO, only one of a small number. And Sean McBride and the inter-party government saw an opportunity here. They believed Ireland was really strategically vital to the Western countries in the Cold War because of its location, because of its agricultural output, because if the Russians did invade or if the Soviets invaded, it would be the last fallback point for NATO forces. So they really thought, okay, we have an opportunity here. Let's say to the Western Allies, we will join NATO if we get the six counties back. Mm-hmm. And so the informal invite went out. We sent an aide memoir back saying, listen, we're very interested. We are very much anti-communist. We're very worried about the communists. But we can't do this while this partition is in effect. And they hoped that would open a conversation that the Americans would pressure the British to give us back the six counties. But unfortunately for the inter-party government, the Americans basically told us to get lost. Ireland would be nice to have in NATO, but not vital in any way. You know, you'd improvements in long-range aircraft that, you know, could kind of bypass Ireland from a defence point of view. And they also had Northern Ireland in NATO, you know, so they had a good chunk of the country that was already.
So they obviously looked at the Irish negotiating position and thought, you're all right. We're not going to get involved in that.
Exactly. They did make some limited effort, actually, interestingly, to go through the church to maybe pressure. They asked John Charles McQuaid to maybe put pressure on McBride. They were friends. If Ireland would join NATO with no strings attached. Mm-hmm. But even though it was a very Catholic government and society, they told McQuaid as well to get lost. And so we said no to NATO, or the Americans basically said no to us, and we framed it as us saying no to NATO. And neutrality didn't feature in that debate one little bit, according to the documents I saw. And there was another document in 1959 where the DFA were again asked to look at, should we join NATO? And they decided we shouldn't. They gave a list of reasons. Neutrality did not feature there once.
Okay, well, we'll come up to the present day now, because you describe very well our vulnerability now. And why is it, and how much would we need to invest in order to be able to make ourselves less vulnerable to a potential attack, whether that is a military attack or a cyber attack like we saw on the health service in 2021?
Of course, yeah. I mean, this stuff doesn't come cheap. It's massively expensive. And one of the problems, it's so hard to get agreement for increased defence spending, is you're talking about still relatively remote threats. You know, so the best way to look at defence is an insurance policy for the worst case happening. But we, you know, it's incredibly unlikely we're going to be invaded or bombed by the Russians or by China or the Americans or anyone else. But there's, you know, the new type of warfare, this hybrid warfare, where it's below the level of, you know, your traditional kinetic warfare involving tanks and guns and bombers. It's cyber attacks. It's state-sanctioned cyber attacks. Now, the HSE attack wasn't a state-sanctioned cyber attack, but a lot of the people who were involved in it do work for the Russian government, or, you know, kind of in a freelance basis. You've got things like the interference with the cables, the mapping of the cables in our off our west coast. You know, this is stuff that falls below the standard of, you know, traditional warfare.
So they're insidious attacks.
Exactly.
That really have potential to undermine a state.
And the internet as well is such a massive attack vector, to use the jargon, you know, which opens up the risk of election interference. Like, take, for example, if we were to have a border poll, there will be various countries who would be interested in causing disruption to that poll, to, you know, flooding the area with misinformation, just as they did in the US election and the French elections and in various elections.
And you include Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the impact that's had on the number of people who've come to Ireland. That is also hybrid warfare, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is migration as a weapon, you know. This is... Vladimir Putin knew one of the side effects of invading Ukraine, and from his point of view, one of the bonuses of invading Ukraine would be driving this unprecedented wave of migration into Western countries, which he hoped and was right about to a limited extent would pressure the US or the Western governments to not support Ukraine, to think twice about, you know, continuing the war by, you know, arming Ukraine and that sort of thing. So we've also seen that in the South as well. You know, you've got Russian mercenaries in the South who are destabilizing countries down there. The Wagner group are operating in all these really unstable regions. That's causing other waves of migration.
So look, let's divert slightly, but we're still staying on track with the Russians, because we've heard a lot about the Russian embassy in Dublin and what happens there. How important is it in terms of espionage?
Massively important, and always has been. The Russian embassy, so, you know, I kind of get into it in the book in the context of neutrality during the Cold War, and is it possible to be neutral in the Cold War? If it is, we certainly weren't. We were very much on the side of the Western powers and overtly on the side of the Western powers. That's the extent that we didn't want the Russian embassy to be opened here. Various defence officials said that we don't have enough guards to shadow all the spies that would be coming over here. And when it did eventually open, Gareth Fitzgerald said we should open this for economic reasons, one of the few remaining countries in Europe that didn't have one. The guards were on them very, very closely. Maybe, you know, the only thing comparable was how much they monitored subversive groups like the IRA at the time. And so Russian diplomats were subject to very strict rules that other diplomats weren't, such as if they wanted to go outside of Dublin, they had to give written notification to the Department of Foreign Affairs, give their registrations over, that sort of thing. And that suspicion, that paranoia was justified to the extent they were engaged in contacts with the official IRA. They were engaged in, you know, gathering intelligence, including one member memorable affair, the Lipizov affair, where Russian diplomats were caught receiving US military secrets in Stillorgan Shopping Centre, which led to the first expulsion of Russian diplomats, and far from the last, though, of course.
Conor, we'll have to leave it there, but it's fascinating, and it's a fascinating look back over history, how we got to this point and all of the discussions that are happening now. It's very pertinent and very relevant, and the book is out now. It's called Is Ireland Neutral? It's written by Conor Gallagher, and you'll find it in your local bookshop. Thank you very much. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.